Welcome to Punch Card Investing, a weekly show dedicated to all things value investing. Whether it be analyzing companies, pitching ideas, or discussing moves by the best investors in the world, we're trying to get one step closer to punching an investment off of our cards. Let's get started.
Thank you, Intro Man, as always. I'm live from a new location this time, guys. I'm back in Chicago for the weekend. So I apologize in advance because I'm on a new Wi-Fi network that is not my own. So I don't know how this is going to hold up, but hopefully it holds up fine. But good to see you guys. We have Patrick returning after a couple weeks, after making his initial appearance on the Punch Card Show. Good to have you back, Patrick. And Tom, good to see you as always. New time for you, nice and early in the morning. first time on this new time slot. So hopefully that is all well and good. But we're going to be talking about value traps and financial risks that might be easy to overlook, or maybe shouldn't be easy to overlook when it comes to this wide world of value investing, and maybe go over some examples of potential value traps or value traps that have happened previously that might have looked attractive, and now we're kind of seeing it play out as, oh no, that definitely was a value trap. So we'll go over some examples like that. But before we get into that, definitely check out all the great stuff in the description below. We got our discount links to ShareSite and Seeking Alpha, so check that out. They have free plans as well if you want to try them out. And then also check out our Discord if you haven't already to join the community there and stay up to date on future events and things like that. One thing I did just set up on the channel is a membership tier. If you're on YouTube, YouTube has memberships, and they're trying to encourage creators to use that membership option. So I did add like a basic membership if you want to support the channel that way. Right now you get a couple unique emojis, and then it also shows your status as a contributor to the channel or something like that. So if you want to support the channel that way, it's a new way you could. We'd appreciate it as always. And we'll try to add some more things and membership tiers, exclusive live streams and that sort of thing potentially in the future. And we'll keep you posted if and when we do that. But there is now a membership option on YouTube. I have no idea how it'll do or really what it will really look like, but you do get a Monish mustache emoji that I entered in there, and a money printer as well. So off to a great start there. So if you want to check that out, that's now an option on the channel. All right. So where do we want to start? How are you guys doing anyways? but before we get into the devastating world of value traps, are we all in a good mood today?
Yeah, not too bad. Been a little sick this week, so that's why I was just telling you guys before we went live here. That's why I sound like I've been chain smoking for the last 40 years or something. But yeah, doing not too bad.
It's like 7 a.m. Yeah. Your time, Tom. Not quite as early as it's been for Karan in the past. He's been like 6 a.m. his time. So
yeah, I've had it easy all this time, just mid afternoon. So
I'm in your old slot right now, Saturday afternoon, as is Patrick. Like I said, good to see you again, Patrick. I hope all is well with you. You were kind of pitching this topic a little while ago. You were like, hey, maybe a value traps episode or something like that would be good in the future. I'm like, yeah, it's always a relevant topic in our space. So I'm not sure kind of I don't want to put you on the spot, but anything you kind of had in mind there, just like with the general value traps?
I guess, yeah, with the value trap idea was more, I think people use that term a lot. And I mean, you hear it on almost every channel, but nobody really knows what it is or like what to actually look out for. It's kind of shorthand for something that looks too good to be true. So I thought like going through some of the actual metrics to look for, real examples, that sort of thing would be really interesting. And I got some notes and a couple books that I think do a good job tackling that too.
I guess, why don't we go ahead and try to define value trap? At least the way I think about it is it's something that has the allure of a good deep
value. Jack, you're breaking up a little bit.
Not that deep, but you know, you're getting it for right now. Hopefully it's not too.
Jack, you're in the Matrix.
Am I back?
Yeah.
Am I back now? So. Okay, great. Yes, Of course, it's right as I'm talking. Like I said, I'm on a new Wi-Fi network. So, you know, this Wi-Fi network might be an example of a value trap. You know, I think it's a free, great alternative, and you just run into this sort of thing and nothing you can do about it. I don't know. But at least the way I think about a value trap is it's something that seems like it's below its intrinsic value for a variety of like logical reasons. But the trap is that you don't really, you're overlooking some major detail or details that don't allow you to unlock that what seemed like good value, or maybe there was never good value in the first place because of just the way it was packaged or industry it was in or something like that. So it's something that looks great but actually isn't. Sounds great, doesn't work, in the words of a president. that's kind of how I think of it. I don't know if you guys think of it any differently.
No, I think I agree with what you said.
Oh, wonderful. Makes it easy. Same. All right. And maybe we should just dive into some examples potentially recently or not of kind of value traps.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I have a couple of things. So just talking about some books. Okay. First off, Quality of Earnings. This was written a long time ago, but it's like I feel like it was written before cash flow statements, because a lot of the stuff he talks about was how to detect, you know, future earnings, like missteps, things like that, by looking at current trends of whether it's inventory, receivables, just funny accounting. And, you know, I think that's a good one to start with. And I can kind of show you an example of something that I fell for too. And I think a lot of people did. And that is, Intel. Okay. So Intel last year, tell me whenever you can see the screen. Okay. See it.
Yeah, we can see it now. The net income of Intel mapped over time.
Let me show you what it looked like whenever, you know, everybody was doing videos, myself included. And, you know, you feel free to go back and roast me in those comments for those videos. This is what Intel's net income looked like. Okay. I mean, everything was good. Revenue was great. Same thing. I mean, a little bit of a dip, but, you know, nothing, there was no red flags, you know, per se, like until, I mean, look at that. Look at your pre-tax income was climbing. And then all of a sudden second quarter last year, it, you know, just fell off of a cliff. And, I think that drastically changed the earnings and, drastically changed the valuation. And so what I wanted to do is kind of look at, you know, what, were there any signs before this happened to kind of look for? And I feel like one of them that they talk about a lot in the, in that book I talked about was inventory. And I feel so dumb for missing this, but, if you look at finished products, and this is just something really neat to look at for any stock, especially somebody that's selling goods and stuff like that, is finished goods inventory. I mean, if it's climbing, that's huge red flag, right? That means they're not selling it. Nobody wants to keep finished goods. That's, you know, the last thing anybody. It's okay. And the book talks about this, if raw materials is climbing, because they might be prepping for, you know, increased demand, stuff like that. But so looking at overall inventory isn't always that good, but looking at finished goods is important. And you can see that climb was happening, you know, starting third quarter 2021, and that income drop really didn't happen until second quarter 22. So I feel like catching that would have been, would have given you some heads up, you know, but,
yeah, interesting that you saw both raw materials and finished goods rising at the same time. Ideally, you'd want to see, if you have a bunch of finished goods, you'd expect raw materials to go down too if you're turning those raw materials into finished goods. But yeah, obviously a demand drop off of some sort, or oversupply, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in general, this will show as well, if you don't want to go through the trouble of looking at inventory and all that, it will show on the cash flow, because, you know, a change in inventory is going to be, you know, cash out and then inventory up. So like, if you were to look at their free cash flow, it kind of, the start of it's, I mean, it didn't really start dropping until the fourth quarter 2021. So about a quarter delayed from the inventory, but still would have given you more heads up than, you know, waiting till, I guess, mid 2022 to find out that something was really up with Intel. So
those are some pretty wild swings in cash flow. Was there a change in how they were accounting for certain things at any point? I haven't followed Intel too closely. I just know it was on a lot of people's radars for the reason you see kind of stated before. But was there like a change in how they were accounting for something?
No, I'm looking for that. So it was from the operating cash flow, and it change in working capital. So something, I don't know, something with the, it wasn't inventory, because we just saw that, right? So
yeah,
we can dive into, I mean, receivables maybe. Yeah, there it is. Big change in receivables. And that's another thing that this book touches on too, is how to look at accounts receivable and changes of patterns there. Because what will happen is that companies will change their payment structure to, you know, offer their customers better payment terms so that they can go ahead and book the sales, you know. But then they have so it shows up fine on the income statement, right? But it's booked as a sale there, but the cash hasn't arrived yet. It's just a change in receivables. So that, I guess that would be here a negative, but that's just one example.
Sure.
Yeah. That's Intel. I don't know. Do y'all have, and look, I could say this and then they could go skyrocket up next week.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It works.
They were just prepping for that future growth.
Patrick, with Intel, I haven't followed it particularly closely, but were there sort of qualitative things that you think you missed around like what was happening in their core business to anything happen?
Qualitative, yes. I think it was more. I think I just ignored those because I had like a set of check marks as far as just like the finances go, and like I showed that trend before it dropped off, and it I was just going by purely that. Now I will say, seeing the collapse of Intel, or just seeing the post-mortem, has given me gave me more appreciation for Micron, and actually was able to, if anything came out of that, it was my conviction on holding Micron through everything, you know. So that was good. But like I talked about last video, the Micron got taken away through some covered calls because I was stupid. Yeah. But yeah, Intel, that there was this really neat video from, I think it's Cold Fusion. He's a YouTube he does a good job telling stories. And I feel like there's two sides of investing. There's the more, you know, tactical, fine numbers, that sort of like, you know, diving into the weeds. And then there's kind of the overall story, and you kind of need to pay attention to both. I mean, obviously if you just do the story, then you buy things like nothing but Chipotle and Costco. Mm-hmm. And you know, that might not be a bad thing, but I think that you still have to pay attention to some of the financials. Yeah. And I just did the financial side. So that was my learning for sure.
I've heard a lot of negative things about Intel as well compared to their competitors. We're seeing some in the chat as well, like compared to say AMD or NVIDIA or some of the kind of big players in space, or Taiwan Semiconductor, of course.
Yes.
Why? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, as far as value traps go, I think that is another kind of red flag, is all the competitors are really overpriced, and you got this one that's just, you know, usually if it's too good, like I said, if something's too good to be true, it's probably not true.
That was my stopping point. It's like, yeah, all these others have run up like big time, but this one isn't, like, and it seems so obviously good if you just look at the surface numbers. And that is a good point. It's like, if you have someone lagging behind, check to see if there's a reason for that first, because there might very well be. And it looks like that's what a lot of people got hit with recently here with Intel. So that's a good point. Tom, any thoughts on Intel? You never got into Micron, did you? I think you just looked at it.
No, I haven't been in either of these.
Yeah. Micron being the one of Monish's U.S. holdings, I believe he still holds and it has had for some time, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was just a circle of confidence thing for me.
Yeah, right. What made you comfortable, Patrick, to get into Micron? You are an engineer.
I have a whole video about that. Yeah. So you probably overestimating
chemical.
I'm a chemical engineer. That's nothing to do with electrical stuff. You know, that's near probably enough. my weak point. But I think it was literally just looking at the chart, at the financials, and trending it, and like saying, mm-hmm. okay, look, this. They were making good return on equity. They were growing. I said the only concerns I had were like the high CapEx, high R&D, and I think somebody mentioned that too. It's, I think that's where
fair enough.
Didn't even think about the other side. Now, Micron is in memory, which is a much more fixed. That's what I've come to appreciate is like the technology there is much more related to things like Moore's Law. And you're not going to, like, processors have a lot more, and you'll see more step changes more, there as far as efficiency.
More room to innovate.
Yeah. And so I think I can totally see the Micron thing. Like I said, I'm so sad that I don't own it anymore. Like, it went up like 30-40%, and I was all excited with my 5% weekly or two. I was making like 2% a week on covered calls, you know. And
are options a value trap?
I've regretted every single. The only two I do are protected puts and covered calls, and
right.
I have I like actually have it on my account where like I have it disabled and it has to go through my wife to be activated. And I'm like, you never activate that no matter what I tell you, you know, like, I've regretted every option I've done. It's just, I feel like it's whenever I sell the covered calls, I feel like I've been always, I don't know, like there's a reason I was getting such a high premium. And then the protected puts, it ties up cash, you know, because you can't, I don't do anything on margin. So whenever I sell a protected put, I can't use the cash for anything else. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. I feel like the covered call is a harder one to swallow because you miss out on all those gains, especially when you move past it. At least with the put, it's like, well, I didn't want to buy it unless it hit that price anyways, which is a little different, mm-hmm. you know. I hear you there. Oda Prime says, imagine spending $44 billion a year in R&D and CapEx and still getting blown away by their competitors. That's a tough space. And like you said, there's a bunch of big competitors that their stocks were exploding. So in the positive direction. So, you know, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot that still changed.
They spent way more than
$44
billion, didn't they?
What did you say?
Meta spent far more than $44
billion. Yeah.
Did they spend? No, they spent like, they spent a few bill in the year. It's probably 15, if I remember correctly, for the 1 year of augmented reality, virtual reality stuff. So that was just 15. So maybe across the whole company is probably closer to 44.
So Meta, did y'all buy Meta whenever it was on the operating table?
Yeah, I did. I did when it got much closer to 200, and it was below 200 for a while. And mm-hmm. It was below, what was it, 100? It's been a while since I've looked at the stock, since I sold out of all of my stocks a couple months ago now. When it hit that trough, when the media was like attacking them for their crazy spending into VR, mm-hmm. it was around when I was buying. So that actually worked out well.
That would have been one that if you would have told me what's a value trap, you know, it would have been like, oh, it's, I think Meta is, you know, because I thought, but I was wrong there.
Even when it had dropped to that level, maybe now I could totally see the case now.
I whenever it had dropped there, I just, see, that was me focusing on the story. I just didn't want to own that. I don't know. It was something about, yeah, I think sure. I watched his interview on Lex Fredman and I was like, I don't think he's
that
a
makes
bad
it
guy,
harder.
But yeah. I disagree with like everything, every vision of the future that he has, you know,
that, so I guess was, that's fair. But, yeah. But I could definitely see, you could see it as a value trap now. That's certainly much more than it was when it was half the price, right? Yeah. His earnings haven't doubled. But I think it really depends on your opinion on the ads business, because that's still the core. So it's like, if you think that's declining, but you're paying attention to the allure of all the cash flow now, it's like, oh, you know, even if it declines a bit, that might be fine. Well, declining business is that's a tough one to hold, and you got to get it for a real good price, because you don't want it to decline past your price, you know, your intrinsic value that you calculated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Tom, what about you? What's been your, I guess, have you gotten any value traps or specifics or high level?
Yeah, I've got plenty. I tried to write down a list of sort of general categories that they tend to fall into before we kind of went live here. I think you covered one with Intel really well, which is basically just completely overestimating what the future earnings and cash flows look like. I think that's the one I've been most guilty of. It reminded me of a quote. I want to say it's from Manoj Pabrai, but I'm not entirely sure. He basically said, there's no such thing as value traps. It's just bad investments. And, you know, we're making investments, we're trying to make some sort of estimate of, we're trying to make some sort of estimate of what future cash flows look like typically. And sometimes we just get that wildly wrong for whatever reason. So I think you covered that one really well. I've had some others in the past that, looking back now, are just like super basic and would never happen again gladly, but I'll put them out there just so people are aware. One really straightforward one that I was guilty of a couple of times in the early days was just not appreciating the amount of debt that a company had, and it looked a whole lot cheaper on something like a price to earnings basis, for example. Mm-hmm. So that might be something like GrafTech I was invested in back in the day. They were quite a leveraged company. So if you looked at their price to earnings or price to free cash flow, looked very cheap. But if you looked at it on an enterprise value basis, it looked, you know, reasonably priced, basically. You know, there was a big kind of delta between those two. So that's one that has caught me out a couple of times. Something like Qurate probably goes into that bucket.
You said Keurig, like the coffee?
No,
Qurate. Qurate, like QVC and
All
that kind of stuff. I think that's traded. I don't know where it's at now. I think their earnings have declined quite a bit. But for a long time, that was trading at like a PE of 2 or 3. But on an enterprise value, it might have been like 5 or 6 times that, because it was so leveraged.
So, it's sort of like risk adjusted versus not, you know, oh yeah, it's a 10% return, but if your 10% return relies on 1,000,000,000% in debt, you know, that's not going to do too well. or you know, you're not getting an adequate return for the risk, perhaps, is one way to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, these days I sort of think about it like buying a rental property. Like when you, obviously, when you go into a rental property, oftentimes you are borrowing money and you have leverage in that situation, and that does impact your return. But typically, when you're analyzing the deal in the first place, you're looking at it, you know, as if it had no debt, and if you just paid entirely cash for the house, you know, versus the rent, what would that kind of look like? So that's definitely one.
So kind of adding on to that, I've done the same thing with whenever I was first investing. I think the thing that made the most sense was just going after things that were book value, you know, less than whether it was some things less than working capital. But one of the stocks I found, and it's a little smaller cap, so I have a video on them, but they were called, it was RYAM. It was a pulp and paper products, and you know, it was anyway chemical plant, but they were selling at like a, I don't know, 60% of book value or something like that, and less than working capital, but they had, I mean, their debt was just enormous compared, and they had all these assets because they had all this fixed equipment that required tons of capital and all that. So I think I was just taking the difference of that and not, you know, and saying, oh, well, they have all this debt, but they have all these assets too, but not factoring in that the assets were not very liquid, you know? So I think going off of the balance sheet has just been, I don't know. I almost have never seen that work out for me, at least, you know, buying something just because of the balance sheet, you know. So the reverse, you know.
Yeah, because you kind of need a catalyst at some point. So if you don't have a catalyst, you know, how good are the assets really?
What do you mean by a catalyst?
Well, maybe I'm mixing it up with liquidity, but you need something to unlock the asset value. And, you know, if cost associated with selling that thing, or if in order to recognize that value, we're relying on liquidation, well, how long is liquidation going to take? You know, because even if you have a great balance sheet, if the company's losing money in the meantime, or, you know, the earnings are falling, it might kind of eradicate a lot of that asset value.
I remember Charlie had a quote one time where he's like talking about Warren's old days of investing, you know, where he was going after cigar butts, and Charlie's like, you know, it's just not fun, you know, saying, gee, I hope this sucker liquidates before it loses all the money, you know, something.
Right. Like exactly. That. Exactly.
And, I have a video about that where, you know, I think if you're buying stuff based on liquidation value, every second that the value's not realized hurts your investment returns. Whereas if you buy something off of earnings and earnings growth, you don't care whenever, you know, the market recognizes true value, because, you know, if you bought the right thing, it's going to grow and you'll get the same net, you know, compounded return, no matter how long it takes.
Sounds a little like SRG, perhaps. Jury's still out, but you know, it took a long time for them to get to the liquidation of the portfolio, which was kind of the main thesis. It's like there's a lot of real estate here that's above your liabilities, and it took a while for them to get started. And maybe it's too late now that cap rates have risen again. Is that going to eliminate the equity that people thought they had before? You know, it's just another example of the time problem. And I think it also goes into what Tom was saying about overestimating future earnings. I don't want to say like you should focus on interest rates too much, but if your thesis relies on interest rates being zero forever, you know, for something like a real estate company, that's food for thought. Is that really a good value, or is that a trap?
No, I think anything that relies on the macro,
is
potentially a value trap. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
you could say the same thing about, you know, it's sort of, if you buy some of those like really low cap rate, do you call them low cap rate, high cap rate? When
I guess low cap rate would mean expensive properties.
Yeah, exactly.
Low cap rate, low yield, you know, that's the same thing.
It's similar to buying like being SVB and buying a bunch of really safe bonds.
Kind of. Right.
Yeah. Very exposed to interest rates.
Yeah. I did want to say, just because Tom, you had mentioned overestimating future earnings, the other side of the same coin is overestimating past earnings and thinking that will continue. I had that with Turtle Beach because it's a very cyclical company, and I thought, oh, you know, they're doing real well, so they'll kind of carry a lot of that momentum into whatever. And they, instead of doing that, they followed their normal history of being a cyclical, and you know, those earnings fell down. Now, will they come back in the future? History would suggest maybe, but I'm not going to make a call at this point. But that's, I think, one common value trap. This kind of goes to the Peter Lynch school of how he kind of categorizes stocks, one of them being cyclicals. We saw a ton of that with like 2020, 2021, when there was just massive spending splurges, and it made everyone's earnings in a lot of industries look really good. And you have to try to normalize those a bit, like, hey, you know, this was really just a one-off event. Are we really going to have 2021 levels of spending forever in whatever industry? It's one thing to keep in mind. I saw it a lot when I was looking at small businesses to buy, is a lot of them had these just massive 2021s or 2020s even after like a little blip down, they just shot up and now they're falling down. Maybe not that fast, but they're still kind of relying on, they're pointing to their 2021 earnings. Like, look how great the business is. But even though their 2023 earnings might be, you know, 60% of that number, and now you're not getting such a great deal at that price. So cyclicality is definitely something to keep in mind in any industry, and just big one-off years. You really want to see a history of success, ideally.
Yep.
But yeah.
Yeah. Cyclicality. I actually have a lot of cyclical stocks, and I think it just, things like debt and all that are way more important because you want to be able to survive the trough periods. And, you know, especially if you have competitors that have a lot of debt, you might come out on the other side, you know, and have a bigger market share. So, yeah, it's.
Ooh, real quick, just because I forgot to mention it, we got a super chat from Ricardo from Switzerland. It says, great timing for a Swiss viewer, and thanks for the great content so far. We appreciate the super chat, and glad that you could make it live. Since we're trying out new times, like I said, it's an hour later than we did in our previous episode. We're going to try to mix it up a good bit in the future. Probably do a lot more around this time in the future. But either way, we'll try to have some more midweek episodes as well, both live and pre-recorded. So subscribe if you haven't already for those of you who are watching this either live or after the fact. And hit the bell notification so you know when we are going live and you can join the live chat. But thank you, Ricardo. Now, any others? Any other good examples, perhaps? You fit a number.
Well, Tom, do you have more categories?
Oh yeah, I've got
oh,
a
few. Yeah. Oh yeah,
No, the next probably the next best one after, or next most common one I've kind of found myself falling into after this, just overestimating future earnings, is just kind of having a very mediocre to poor business that is genuinely cheap, but for whatever reason you just can't get the cash out. Like they don't want to do buybacks or pay a dividend. They keep reinvesting in their core business, which has very low returns on invested capital. Or
it's kind of like the catalyst thing, right?
It's similar. Yeah, I would say so. I think there's a couple of examples. Like if I use GrafTech again, just because the scars are deep, you know, they actually earned not exactly what I expected and what a bunch of people expected in the 3 to 5 years where they had these. I won't go into the story. There's a bunch of old videos on it. But they roughly had the earnings, maybe a little lower than what we expected. But the capital allocation changed quite dramatically. Like going into the investment, they were paying a lot of their free cash flow out as dividends. They were starting to talk about repurchases. They did a little bit of that. But as soon as the pandemic hit, they suddenly got way, way more conservative with the capital allocation. And they started repaying all the debt, you know, all the leverage that I'd missed in a previous value trap example. And there's far worse things you can do than pay down debt. But the point was we weren't going to get the cash out of the thing like we thought we were going to. So that's definitely one. What else did I have? The last one on the list really was just capital expenditure eating all the earnings.
Eating the earnings, you said?
Eating, consuming.
Eating.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come on.
Yeah, my bad. I think it's Munger again. They've kind of talked about really liking businesses where they have this high class problem of it just throws off a bunch of cash and they can't find a home for it in terms of reinvestment. And they really dislike businesses where, you know, you kind of turn up and ask where all the cash is gone, and the owner of the business says to, you know, look out in the yard at all these new trucks they've just bought or what have you. I forget the exact example.
It was used. He was talking about a rental equipment business.
There you go.
That example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like all the profits right out front.
Exactly. So I guess at some point if you liquidate that thing, maybe you see the cash in the end, but it's not the ideal model.
It's an endless cycle. That's my industry where I work is a CapEx, you know, machine. It's just, you know, I'm in the chemical industry and that's everything. Just, it requires so much money to just maintain, operate. You know? Yep. And I think, you know, you asked me last time if I stay in that industry, whenever I started, and I still do, I'm kind of biased towards investing on that side, but it's that has bit me, I think, just because it's there's so much CapEx required just to stay afloat, to tread water. And if you defer it, it doesn't, it compounds on the, you know, whenever you eventually pay it, you know, it's like pay me now or pay me two X, you know, a year from now. So it's a tough business. But I think another one, and this is kind of a lot of it goes to debt. And I think you listen to Monish talk, and like he was saying that of all the, he has this big checklist apparently with all of these traps that other people have gotten into. And he said like a huge percentage of them are debt. And I think just strictly using return on equity as like a, as a, you know, I'm looking for stocks with great return on equity can get you in some binds, because a company can really skew their equity by not having a lot of, I mean, really skew their return on equity by not having a lot of it. And I almost never look at return on equity. I mean, maybe if the debt to equity ratio is really low, but still, I prefer return on assets, return on invested capital. I feel like that's just always a better way to go about it.
One metric, this is a little sort of off topic, but just because it's easy to overlook, is stock-based compensation. So you can see this cash flow number that's super high, and you're like, wow, look at the cash flow they're throwing off. But then because of accounting rules, stock-based comp doesn't necessarily show up there, even though that's really like a cash expense. So it might be inflating its cash flow in a big way, and that downstream could affect return on whatever whatever other metrics. That's one other thing to keep in mind too, at least when it comes to free cash flow, which is something I prefer to look at. But it's not, there's no one all-inclusive metric. You kind of have to look at the whole picture, but that's another big red flag.
Free cash flow. I mean, stock-based comp. I just was looking at Williams-Sonoma, and they're one I've been watching for a really long time. It's kind of like I said, it's like the Peter Lynch quote about companies that your wife likes and stuff like that. That was because Williams-Sonoma is also Pottery Barn, and you know, Pottery Barn Kids, and you know, all that. But there's like 13% of their free cash flow is going to stock-based compensation. They were making like $700 million dollars a year in free cash flow, and stock-based compensation was 100, or you know, so it was wild. And I like discovered that in the middle of the video, and it just put me in a bad mood because it was going so good, you know. I was like, all these things are great, and then I mean, double digit free cash flow percentage to stock-based compensation.
There's some that are a lot more. There's some that are a lot more. But yeah, still, that's a chunk.
I think Coinbase is double digit percentage.
Right, exactly.
From memory.
a lot of the big tech companies, and I mean, they're doing all their layoffs partly to combat that, but you know, it's still going to be a lot to pay out.
Is that because they don't have any though, or not that, and they don't, you know, where your denominator is so low where you're not dividing by a big free cash flow amount? Or okay, because like there's some.
I think it's probably both sides of that equation. Yeah.
Well, Coinbase is going through its own thing right now.
Coinbase is that
we're a crypto exchange, and the SEC's finally, after you know, the SEC prefers to let a bubble inflate, then pop, let a bunch of fraud happen, and then come in after, be like, hey, you know, that was a problem, you know, after the fact. So they're doing that right now with crypto, with some of the big exchanges. We'll see what happens there. But anyways, one other potential value trap. We're going to talk about dividends too much here, but like high dividend yields is another one, or big special dividends that come up, and thinking like, oh, they've had a 10% payout, 10% yield in the last year. Therefore, you know, I'll get my money back real quick. Well, it still comes down to earnings at the end of the day. So avoiding the allure of a high yield, especially if your earnings are declining, then how sustainable is that dividend really? And ultimately, dividends come from earnings. So if earnings are in trouble, that's really where you got to start. It's an easy thing to get distracted by potentially.
I agree. And this might be a wild take, but dividends to me are almost a red flag, because like perfect management, I want to buy back if they have extra cash that they don't want to invest in the business or pay down debt. I'd rather them, if the stock's undervalued, do repurchases, right? And if the stock's not undervalued, then maybe do dividends. But if the stock's not undervalued, why do I want to buy it? You know, that sort of thing. It's kind of a, I actually am not a fan of dividends at all. I'd put all dividends as a value trap, which, like I said, could be a wild take, but I just feel like it's.
I see where you're coming from there. It's because when you look at the alternative of a buyback, the only reason you wouldn't do a buyback if there's nothing else to invest in would be that it's overpriced. But if it's overpriced, why are you holding? That's an interesting point. Like, I hadn't thought of it that far.
Somebody's buying back your stock right now. Ferrari. Yeah, that's what I remember you.
I feel like we've all seen the charts of the buybacks following the market pretty much. If the market's up, buybacks are up, and the market's a bit of a chicken and an egg problem. Like, you know, are the buybacks causing the rise or is the rise causing the buybacks? It's probably a combo of both, but still.
I have a big note here on my thing that says dumb repurchases, and I could show you that with a Sleep Number, but they were
issuing debt to buy stock.
Yeah, their stock was like, okay, now it's what, in the 20s or something, but it was over 100 back at the COVID peak, and they were just spending everything on buying shares back, and then they were still making money, stocks coming down, and they just stopped. I'm like, who's making these decisions, you know? Like, that's one I stayed away from, I think, for a couple of reasons, but I have a video on them too, but
it's not always obvious that share buybacks, we like to think, are always positive, but they really are not. They could put a company in a big, big bad situation, because that's money that's not being kept as cash for reserves. It's money that's not being used to pay down debt. Oftentimes companies will take out debt to continue a buyback program. That's like, that seems like a massive red flag. And unless the stock,
you said what, it seems like a massive red flag to take out debt to buy back shares.
Yeah, yeah, or to sustain a buyback program. You've seen that. Could justify it in some limited cases if it's really that cheap and you get great debt. But even then, like, you got to be super careful levering up to do that.
Yeah, well, like, look at, I think Apple financed their buyback program with like, I think like 4% debt, and like even if they were selling it at 20 times earnings, let's say that's what, 5% IRR. So it's that, in a way, they're kind of like making money, you know.
Well, it's short, I don't want to call it arbitrage because it introduces more risk, but yeah, I see what you're saying. That's what I'm saying. Like, it can make sense, but it's still a red flag nonetheless. Like, just you gotta make sure that this really does make sense and they can weather a storm, because you're introducing more debt. That's more risk if something happens. Apple's in a fine position, but on that front, but still, financial engine. This kind of leads into maybe financial engineering in general. Kind of links into stock-based comp too. Sometimes executives are encouraged to pump the stock price in the short term to get some payout, and that could lead to some weird decisions too when it comes to levering up to buy back stock. It's kind of a subset of what we've already been talking about, but.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing very briefly on the dividends versus buybacks thing.
Yeah.
outside of the US, I don't know if other countries do it. There's none that I'm familiar with, but I'm sure they exist. In New Zealand and in Australia as well, buybacks are actually probably less on Australia, but in New Zealand especially, buybacks are actually very unusual. There's a couple of companies that do them, but it's not a common occurrence like in the States at all. And that's mainly because we have this dividend imputation credit system, which, you know, in the US, you have the problem of the company pays tax on their earnings. They pay that out to the investor and the investor pays tax on that dividend income. We don't have that issue in New Zealand, that your dividends have come with like a tax credit attached, basically. So there's no tax leakage with paying the dividend versus buying back shares like in the States. So. Thought I'd just put that out there too.
That's a big reason you've seen buybacks kind of replace dividends in a lot of places, or you know, a preference towards that. Just at least in the US, it is a big tax consideration for investors.
I think the mentality over here, except in, you know, some cases where there have been a small amount of repurchases, I think the mentality over here is for companies to kind of give the cash back to the investor, and
if
the investor wants to buy the stock back themselves, sort of thing, they can do it. There's no tax disadvantage to
that. Yeah, no, that makes a big difference for sure. Yeah. The nobody here and nobody that watches it is an EBITDA fan, right? So we don't have to mention that as a value trap, I hope.
adjusted EBITDA.
Yeah, I think that goes back to the overestimating earnings point, probably.
Yeah.
Man, I've seen some crazy stuff with EBITDA. Yeah.
That's just a tricky one. Yeah.
I'll go into a company's presentation and just control F EBITDA. And, you know, if it's like 40 times, I'm like, Jesus,
man. It's a good strategy.
But, and there's a lot of them. It's so rare to find somebody that doesn't talk about it, to be honest. Even the stocks I own, some of them, all of them, I think, mention it. Not all of them, but.
Well, it's sort of a tragedy of the commons. It's like, well, if all my industry peers are doing it and mm-hmm. they're benefiting from it, why can't we? You know, I think it's mostly that. It's like, who's gonna? Yeah. You need everyone to be a good egg. But if there's one bad egg, it's like, well, he's getting away with it. Why can't I? I bet it's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Certainly, and you have a same sort of thing with like so-called one-off expenses. Yeah, which tends to come up like every year in a lot of cases.
this would have been our earnings if not for this, and then yeah, that's funny. Next year it's like
we saw that a lot with supply chain. We saw a lot with we're pulling in inventory forward for supply chain mm-hmm. issues, and now we're continuing to pull it, and now we're continuing to pull in. Once this ends, you know, once these supply chain issues end, and then they never end.
Yeah, there was one webcast I was listening to, earnings call, where they were like, well, you know, demand's just depressed because people are anticipating a recession. And then it was like, we're in a recession, so demand's and then it was like, we're coming out of it, but people are still worried. And I was like, okay, this was like three quarters sequentially. And
Always pointing the finger. Maybe, and that might be just a management red flag. You talked about this a lot when on our last show, Patrick, a couple of weeks ago. Just like, is management doing what they say they're doing? And kind of an extension of that is, are they pointing the finger at something that's just like, come on, mm-hmm. like really everyone was dealing with that. Why? And you're going to blame that on why you're lagging behind everyone? Just maybe seeing where they're putting the blame. Are they being honest about not executing something properly, or are they just pointing the finger at market conditions vaguely and making no adjustments mm-hmm. strategy wise? It's another thing.
Yeah. One more thing.
I know you have a hard stop in like 10 minutes, Patrick. So I don't know if you want to pick something to wrap up on, or Tom, you as well.
I have something, then we let Tom finish but I think one of the biggest things with the value trap is avoiding is getting in the right mindset and avoiding things like confirmation bias. And I feel like once you buy something, it's more likely that you stop seeing, you know, potential red flags and all that. And I think like a good rule of thumb is like, instead of asking, like, let's say you see something and you think it's really cheap, instead of saying like, oh, this is so cheap, you know, you need to think like, why is this so cheap? And just taking that mindset in will be much better than the alternative. Try to prove the reverse. Don't do confirmation bias. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's hard to, you have to balance the optimism. Like, or if some people lean like overly pessimistic, some lean overly optimistic, you know, just trying, you have to somehow counterbalance whatever your bias is.
Where would you say y'all are?
I think I definitely lean towards optimistic, which has burned me and also has helped, you know. There's pros and cons to both, but yeah, I definitely lean on the more optimistic and need to pump the brakes a lot more.
What about you, Tom?
I'm probably naturally more pessimistic, I would say. Yeah. Not sure. Like
you come across, for example, like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, like, for example, you'll very rarely see me invest in anything where it's like an all about the future type story. We're going to grow at 50% a year, that type of thing.
Yeah.
That's how it shows up in the investing I guess. So I don't know how you're going to classify that, but
I'm with Jack. I'm probably too optimistic and I need to put safeguards in place to not do anything stupid. You know, it's just the, that's just the American in us. Yeah.
Maybe can do, will do. Yeah. Right. And that's a big reason I decided to sell my stock portfolio. It's like, all right, I'm not even going to pretend like, cause I could look at any of what I was holding and been like, oh yeah, I'd really like to keep owning it. There's still upside. I'm like, no, just screw it. I'm going to stop it right here. And I'm going to focus on fewer opportunities and just try to make those work better. Or what I think has much more upside, even if this might be a decent opportunity, I'd rather just try to consolidate. So it's something I've really been trying to work on very consciously. It's going to take a while to get really good at it, but, I think at least trying to acknowledge your bias, or I don't want to call it a weakness necessarily, but certainly your bias, so it doesn't become a weakness, is a good, probably a good move. if you know where you're coming from, it'll help you when, trying to find the gaps in whatever you're looking at.
Nice. Can we just wrap up with just one stat I've found, just because
we're absolutely talking about it
earlier. So for the year ending December 2022, Coinbase revenue $1.35 billion, Coinbase stock based compensation $1.5 billion.
More than revenue.
About 48% of revenue. Now, granted, that was in a year when revenue was down 60%, so it didn't look as bad the year before. But
you got to look at that previous revenue. It's going to come back. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, if you adjust for that,
if you adjust to last year's revenue, yes, then we're doing great.
Yeah,
exactly. All right, I think that is a wonderful stat to wrap up on, Tom. Appreciate it, Patrick. Good to see you again. I'll hope to have you back again soon. And if anyone has any other people that might be interested in joining us on Punch Card, we're definitely looking for new people to join either the live show or potentially do some midweek shows. So definitely let us know if you know of someone or you are someone who would be interested. You can reach out. If you go to our About page on YouTube, you should be able to see our channel email if you want to send it there. I'll try to do a form as well or some sort of poll on YouTube as well. And there's always Discord too, where you can reach us. So with that said, check out all the great stuff in the description below. Like, comment, subscribe, you know, all that great stuff. We wouldn't want to forget that. But until next time, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to Punch Card Investing. The contents of this show should not be used as investment advice or as a recommendation to invest in a particular security. Please consult with a licensed investment advisor if you need investment advice. All investments carry risk and the potential for monetary loss. Thank you, and see you next week.